Hey guys, you're listening to The Blockchain Socialist, and this is part two of my interview with Dr. Joel Garrod. In the first part, we talked about his recent publication titled On the Property of Blockchains, Comments on an Emerging Literature. It's really good. It's about, of course, property relations on the blockchain and what most other academics miss when analyzing blockchain and comparing it to neoliberal conceptions of property. I'd recommend to give it a listen as well if you can, but it isn't necessary to listen to if you found this part first. So in this episode, we talk more about the differences between the liberal and socialist conception of human rights, as well as the history of the transition between feudalism and capitalism, and how we can sort of relate that to blockchain and possibly transitioning to something beyond capitalism. So if you like the interview, it'd be great if you could give the podcast or whatever way you're listening to it a positive rating on the platform you're using. But yeah, thanks a lot and enjoy. So to switch to, because you've already mentioned it already a couple of times, but there was this interesting seminar that, or a couple of seminars that you sent that I thought were pretty interesting that I hope we could talk about. So one of them was on the SEC regulator, which was, that we talked about that one. But so the other one that I wanted to speak more on was the one that spoke about human rights. And this guy, I don't even remember his name anymore, but he was speaking about how refugees essentially from Iran or Venezuela were able to, to have some sort of amount of wealth by remembering their Bitcoin private keys whenever they went somewhere else so that they would have some amount of money when they arrived. I was just curious what you thought about that talk specifically, because I know we got some thoughts.
Yeah, so I mean, I flip-flop on how, let's say, harsh I want to view this in terms of whether I view it as just a legitimating discourse or whether I want to view it as kind of something that has some value, but maybe they're missing something from it just because of their own perspective. Yeah. But I mean, I certainly think that this is very common within the blockchain space. And so that talk in particular, and that was the first talk for the whole conference. So that really kicked it off. And I'll say too, he had a great camera set up and his slides were very, very nice. So it looked very professional. So I have to give him credit for that. But it's essentially this idea, and again, going back to the notion of a kind of classical liberal view of private property and private property in the self and so on. And so this idea is that anything that restricts the ability of you to do what you want with your private property is oppressive. Right. And so basically in this case, he was talking about how Bitcoin can be a positive thing for human rights by essentially allowing for a non-state controlled currency that would allow all these people in various so-called oppressive regimes to escape those regimes or escape the poverty that's created by their policies or whatever. You know, he gave a lot of examples. Now, to me, that's kind of a classical liberal view of the sense that anything that restricts you from doing what you want with your private property is inherently oppressive. And that's something that, again, if we go back to a lot of the writing around the emergence of capitalism and various authors that were part of that process, you know, Montesquieu, people like Sir James Stuart, you know, they essentially argued the same thing at the time as well. And it's actually remarkable. This will be in an upcoming paper that I'm writing. But they essentially make the same argument. They're like, and the argument is that movable private property, in other words, money for the most part, it basically restricts the sovereign, the king, from being able to seize your property. Because you can start to, maybe you have it in lots of different places, right? It's not just in like your one vault. And maybe it actually isn't even in terms of coinage. Maybe it's in terms of interesting financial instruments. Maybe it's debt that you're holding that someone else is, you know? And what's the king going to do? Come and seize like a fictional piece of debt paper that you have? Like that isn't going to fund a war, right? So it's very fascinating hearing a lot of those earlier authors make the exact same argument that essentially private property in or movable private property is a new property form that's going to completely change governance. And they make that argument that as a result of that kings and their courts and thus the kind of proto-state that emerges at that time essentially has to change how it governs its subjects because it can no longer rely on just seizing what it wants. You know, like let's say I'm the king and I have a very expensive war. I can't just go to the goldsmiths of England, go into their vault, take all their money and be like, thanks for the gold, guys. Appreciate it. You know, and that's of course the goldsmith example is one of the earliest of the creation of a state debt, right? Where essentially the king was going to seize the vaults and the bankers or the goldsmiths being smart were like, hey, wait, last second. How about like we'll just give you what you want, but then it's the state's debt, it's not your personal debt, and the state just has to pay us back over time. And the king was like, great, it's not my money. Yeah, okay, sure. And then he takes his money for his war and, you know, goes about his business. And then all of a sudden you have the creation of a state debt, which then of course the goldsmiths can trade and they can create markets and state debt and so on, which still exists to this day. I mean, we often wonder where governments get a lot of their money. Well, they borrow them from financial institutions, right? That's kind of one of the ways in which capitalism operates today. And that's kind of where that came out of, is that earlier need for the sovereign to find money to finance lots of wars, to get territory, to increase their own wealth, et cetera, et cetera. So I think then that when you relate all this back to that talk, it's kind of a new version of that older kind of discussion about using new, you know, we might not think about it in the same way, but new technologies, and in particular financial technologies, to avoid the state, to get away from the state. And so I thought that was really inherent in that talk, is that kind of earlier classical liberal view. And I mean, all of that is still based on the primacy of private property. You know, like if you watched it, you'll notice that nowhere did he speak of anything related to, you know, other things that might be human rights issues, like healthcare or shelter or having enough food to eat or things like that. It was just being able to have money so that you could do what you needed to do, and that anyone restricting the movement of that money was inherently oppressive and should be fought. And I mean, it should also be mentioned that the Human Rights Foundation that that gentleman belongs to is was created and funded by a expat Venezuelan billionaire. So, I mean, they are
Funny.
also, yeah, kind of weird how that happens, right? So I think there, it's kind of, that's, you know, where I would get maybe the more cynical, pessimist side of me saying, okay, I think all of this is just a legitimating discourse that actually has a bigger role of trying to, again, in a new sort of way on a global plane rather than just the national plane, kind of restricting what the state can regulate, the areas that the state can touch, and that by creating this thing that is kind of inherently runs without a state, and that it's very easy to kind of hide it from states and to move it without those restrictions, that it kind of allows for that sort of so-called freedom to exist. In other words, it's going to be a promoter of human rights by being able to do that, which to me is a pretty narrow view of what human rights probably should be. So.
No, I think because I think if someone were maybe on the liberal side listening to this, they may be like a bit confused, like you know, thinking that as a socialist don't believe in human rights. But the critique I think here is specifically that it was such a narrow view of human rights in its totality, I guess. So many other things that are important to life, not just, I guess, yeah, having money to your name.
Yeah, or just generally the protection of private property. Because I mean, in the liberal view, pretty much most of the what liberals would call human rights, and we should also make the point that, and other people have made this point, that human rights, like the language of human rights and what we consider human rights, emerge with liberalism. It's inherent to the creation of capitalism, and that language is one that we've continued up to this day. Like, even if you look at the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights and all these sort of things, they all are speaking in a very liberal way, right? They still rely on private property, these sort of things. And I mean, most of the things that we consider human rights tend to be civil and political rights. It's kind of notable that, for example, social rights somehow all, despite the fact that, of course, having social rights to education, healthcare, food, clean water, shelter, and so on, I think, just in a common sense level, we could say, of course, those things are all very important for human rights, and yet we don't anywhere see declarations of kind of a social right to those things, right? It's kind of mentioned maybe vaguely, if at all, and tends to be like you have the right to purchase that thing, not you actually have a right to it directly, So that's kind
You
of
have
one
the
thing.
right to purchase private
Yeah.
healthcare plans on the
Exactly.
Obamacare markets.
But I think but that's actually an important point to bring up, because I think for a lot of people with the liberal conception of human rights, that's actually, even if they don't if that's not what they're thinking in their head, that's kind of their line of thinking, what it actually leads to, right? Is that you can purchase that. Because I mean, if you think about even just existing civil rights in many countries, like the freedom of movement, right? Okay, sure. Within a particular territory, I'm free to move. But, if I don't have any free public transportation option, my right to move is mediated by my ability to purchase a car, which for pretty much everyone that isn't extremely rich means I need to use credit because I can't just buy a car, and so there's all these things that mediate our access to those things. We could say the same thing about freedom of speech, right? Yes, I have freedom to say certain things and so on, but is my freedom of speech the same as, let's say, Rupert Murdoch's freedom of speech, who owns Fox and Fox News and all the various, subsidiaries and newspapers around the world? I would argue that his right of free speech is one that gets expressed to a much higher degree than mine ever will, even if I have the internet and so on, right? So I think that's the more kind of what I would consider like a Marxist or leftist kind of critique of liberal human rights, is that they miss the way in which most of those things that they call human rights rely on private property. Like, you need to have private property first to actually adequately express the rest of those rights.
So I was wondering if you can speak maybe a little bit more on sort of the differences in how. We've talked a lot about how a liberal would view human rights, but what would you look for if you make a socialist human rights organization? What are the type of things that you would be interested in? So I think the speaker of this seminar, it sort of just seemed like Bitcoin is good because now these refugees can go. Take their money to another country where they will be in a wage slave again, just in a different country.
Yeah, so I mean, I think like there's probably lots of different ways to express a kind of, let's say, a socialist or communist or whatever understanding of human rights. But to me, at least, kind of fundamental to that would be, like, again, kind of getting away from individual rights, and again, away from viewing the individual as a form of private property. Because again, that's like we have to remember that that's where our understanding of civil and political rights and thus human rights comes from, is that earlier struggle, the liberal struggle to kind of enforce private property at a really deep level, to legitimate it on the basis of a God-granted or natural-granted right that we have just as being humans. So I think fundamentally it would recognize that we are social entities. We are not individual, atomized entities. Instead, we are meaning and kind of full expression of our life is only through other people as well, right? I mean, we even like there's lots of ways that we can take this in a more scientific way in terms of even just how we come to understand ourselves as humans, as children, which fundamentally relies on other people and our reflection of ourselves through them. So there's a good book called Social Selves by Ian Burkett that talks about this. But so to me, that would be the fundamental beginning, would be recognizing that we are fundamentally social creatures. We are not these atomized individuals that existing forms of political doctrine and kind of that eventually gets translated into policies and governance, that we're not that in reality, you know, that that's a fiction. And that it leads us down a particular understanding of what are human rights. So if we take that other view, then to me at least, it would kind of go the other way in terms of social rights, right? And how do we create a system of rights in which everyone is included? You can't exclude people from these rights, you know, and what those rights are probably would have to do with the things that allow us to reproduce ourselves as a species and at a much smaller level individually and as a community or as a family or whatever, you know, unit you want to use. But I mean, like a good example is even like, for example, in the United States during the like kind of after the Second World War, or I guess while it was still ongoing, but just at the end, Franklin Roosevelt proposed a second Bill of Rights for the United States. And that was never put into practice for a lot of reasons. But he essentially argued that political rights that are guaranteed in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are not actually proving adequate to ensure the sort of equality in the so-called pursuit of happiness that, you know, the one of the American governing documents kind of starts off with, right? That you have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? That you have that freedom to kind of follow your dreams, so to speak. But of course, that again relies on having enough private property to do so. So that second Bill of
Small
Rights,
print, small
yeah,
print at the
exactly.
bottom.
Yeah. Someone went through the terms and conditions too fast. They were this small.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you look at what those rights were, and I'm looking at them right now, they were the right to employment, to food, to clothing, and leisure with enough income to support them. Freedom from unfair competition and monopolies, a right to housing, a right to medical care, a right to social security, to education. So these are things that people typically consider economic rights or social rights. And of course, we know that they form the basis for social democracy and not necessarily socialism, because that's kind of where they emerged as a kind of way to balance the violence and inequality that is inherent to capitalism by providing these rights. But of course, that's only if you keep private property, right, in the means of production and all those other things. So if you actually make that into common property as well, just like these other things, then to me, that's a kind of expression of a, let's say, a socialist view of human rights. And again, one that I think we could actually extend beyond humans. I don't think we need to be human exclusionary and that we could say all things should have certain rights, you know, to things. Like, for example, there's lots of animals and other insects and lots of other things that are very important to our ecosystem on the planet that basically have no say in anything that's happening and are getting literally killed by us. And we could actually transform that, right? And we could do that by putting into law some of these values in terms of systems of rights. So to me, that would be kind of an alternative. But again, for some people, that might not be radical enough. And they might say, you're just trying to transform capitalist rights into something else, you know? But I think fundamentally, that's a really easy way to do it because it literally, like, you know, if we want to break this down to its most abstract thing, everything that we're talking about centers around the problems of living together as a species on this planet with lots of other species and lots of finite resources that are also very precarious. And so to me at least, to kind of be able to do that appropriately and hopefully sustainably so that we can keep doing it in the future is understanding that we can't keep restricting everyone from the things that they need to survive. You know, none of us chose to be born in the place that we are or in the income level that we are. No one chooses to be born into poverty and these sort of things. And these are all things that are completely within our grasp to transform, but it requires us to actually kind of enunciate a number of principles or values in the same way that those early, you know, those early capitalists, they enunciated Bill of Rights that said, I want freedom of private property. I want freedom of speech and freedom of association and freedom of movement. Well, I mean, it's not that hard to do the same thing on the left as well. And we could equally do that. And I mean, you see some examples of that in places like Bolivia, where, you know, they've tried to enshrine like environmental rights and create a kind of environmental Bill of Rights to give the environment rights to be able to actually legislate against that, right? Because of course, all this comes down to what do you do when someone like kind of abrogates those rights, or they try to take them away, or they interfere with them in some way, right? And so if you all of a sudden have a system that enforces a common property right that says, hey, like you all get clothes, you know, and then someone's like trying to steal extra clothes to sell them on the side or something, you can be like, hey, no, you're getting fined, or you're going to some other community jail or whatever, you know, much more beneficial socialist form of punishment we want to think of. But ultimately, you still have something to be like, hey, that's not right, you know, and that's like a wrong value that we want to have in our society. So,
yeah, I think that's well said. So beyond your interests, your research interests in blockchain, I understand that you also have some research interests in the history of the transition between feudalism and capitalism. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could, I guess, give us a crash course on what that sort of, how did that transition happen?
Sure. So I'll maybe start from the kind of perspective that we're particularly on the left probably all familiar with already, and, you know, given to us by older Marxist historians. And of course, this is the story of capitalist revolution, right? That, you know, regardless of how it happened, whether it was the accumulating of capital over time to a certain degree, where the earlier feudal restrictions on the movement of that capital or the use of it became frustrating. But we have this older model where that happened, and then capitalists caused some big revolt, the big merchant revolutions and so on, and they overturned these monarchies, and then they created new systems of laws that enforce their private property rights, and they put those at the basis of their constitutions, and the rest is history. Now, certainly there are elements of that that are very true, with like many histories. But I think we tend to, having had that story, kind of stop there, and we focus on those revolutions, right? So there's been lots of work over time looking at, you know, the class content of those revolutions, and then looking at other revolutions and saying, you know, who's the class that this revolution is for, or these sort of things. But of course, when you actually look at the actual history and the times when these things are happening, they involve typically lots of different classes. It's not just one class. And they also tend to circle around particular problems or these kind of matters of concern, right? So they're not necessarily enunciated in the way that we have come to understand them after the fact, right? So, for example, you know, at the time when we might think capitalism was emerging during, let's say, the 17th century, and you have first the English Civil War and then the Glorious Revolution, and then roughly, you know, almost 100 years later, you have the kind of American and French revolutions, and then all the revolutions in Latin America and so on. And we think about all those kind of bourgeois revolutions, but we kind of neglect the fact that, you know, it wasn't like they knew that they were creating capitalism, right? Instead, they were fighting against certain things that were problems for them much more locally and specifically. I mean, Adam Smith, writing in the late 18th century, called the thing that we now call capitalism the society of perfect liberty, right? So, I mean, the term wasn't even invented then, So how could, you know, if we look back, we're kind of putting what happened later into the mouths of these earlier so-called capitalist revolutionaries and understanding that history, where when we actually look at how that transition happened, it happened a lot earlier, not necessarily in the transition directly from feudalism to capitalism, but the sort of property relations and in particular, let's say struggles or problems that surround those relationships, the dynamics that would be caused by them, that then eventually over a few hundred years play out to the degree that they do where there's some revolutions. So for example, you know, we can look at much earlier enclosure movements, you know, that started in the 12th century in various countries, like places like England, where you started to have the privatization of certain forms of land. Certainly, we have this view that feudalism consists as well of, you know, not really a money economy, but rather a more kind of economy in kind, so that peasants might pay their lord taxes in the form of goods and things like that. But of course, when we actually look, we find that this transformation to both like leasing land from kind of early capitalist farmers happens way earlier than we think. It's kind of, you know, already in the 14th century, certain countries had almost no form of kind of in-kind tax payments and things like that. Primarily were paid in money. Churches, for example, which we often think about, you know, we think about the restrictions on usury and things like this, interest lending. We think about that as kind of the heart of the feudal system, and the church was inherently against all these practices. But yet, of course, we find on the estates of the church, because the church is one of the largest landowners during the feudal period, no, they're engaging in profit-making activities all the time, and consistently find that when they have a surplus, what do? They don't just give it to people, or they don't exchange those things, they sell it. And this act of profit-making happens much earlier and starts to kind of transform in the whole system in lots of different ways. So one of which happens very closely at even the level of the arrangement of estates and where, for example, peasants were located on the estates and who had rights to what land. Because of course, once money becomes more important, lords want to make more money because that allows them to buy these new luxury goods that are starting to emerge, which only they can afford. And of course, conquest becomes more difficult and also frustrating for those lords that are doing pretty well, you know, because the knights themselves, at a certain point, they kind of, you know, there's not really anything to conquest. There's no lands to take over. There's no places to pillage. And they're kind of getting frustrated and bored. And so it's quite interesting because you start to see even from the kind of the monarchies that are emerging, these absolutist monarchies, that there's a process where they have to actually create new kind of regulations and rules to keep these knights from really, you know, screwing it up for those of them that are doing really well, you know, and making lots of money. And so at the level of the states, things like wine, for example, that were long held as the kind of the lord's most kind of important thing that he was growing. And so usually the vineyard would be very close to the lord's own manor and would be something that he owned kind of directly himself. It wasn't something that was like, you know, he was just taking a bit of it. He would take, like, that was his. And then increasingly, you find some of them start to be like, oh, wow, I could actually, you know, I'm growing really good wine here. I'm growing good berries. I could sell this for money. And so they start selling. So then that makes that vineyard much more important. And a lot of wine was created in regions all across Europe that we would not think would typically be wine producing regions. So that's another shift that starts to happen because, well, geez, if I can just buy some really good wine from that guy over in France, why are we spending all this time and labor on my shitty little vineyard here in England? You know, and I, you know, they have the good stuff over. Why don't we just buy it? Like, what can we do to make money to then buy that stuff, right? So there's a whole host of examples like that when you actually go into the very specific histories of different countries in Europe throughout that period that we call the feudal period, where those transitions are happening a lot earlier. And so a few others, of course, are the rise of towns, you know, where you have a system of rights emerge that are kind of almost protected. But then, of course, as some of the merchants in those towns make more and more money, and the monarchs that rule over those towns realize, like, hey, I can tax these people and get a lot of actual money, and that actually having these towns in my territory is making me rich. I want these towns, you know. And interestingly, that's kind of a conflict between the monarch and the other nobles that own a bunch of land, right? Who maybe they don't have a way of making money as easily or whatever. And so there kind of becomes interesting alliances between the merchants and the monarchs against some other nobles, depending on the country, plays out in different ways in different areas. And yeah, kind of all these things play out in this way where much earlier you get even attempts to kind of, as I think I referred to it earlier, of kind of trying to kind of think of ways to fit in these existing, let's say, we can call them profit-making, but like we might understand them now as just economic activities, but to fit them into existing systems of laws. Because of course, again, there wasn't at that time one national law. Like we're used to the rule of laws applying to everyone in our territory. But back then, you had six or more different bodies of law. The law would change from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and that jurisdiction would be much smaller than we're used to because it depended on smaller lords and their territories that they potentially governed. Similarly, some monarchs in some cases ruled over people and not territories. And so you had a lot of overlapping jurisdictions. And so again, there's multiple legal systems at that time. And depending on what you were doing and how you were doing it, your activities might apply to different legal systems, or you could actually say, no, I want to be tried in the court of that lord because that's where I'm originally from, or things like this. So it's a lot more complex, actually, than we're used to, even today in the way we understand our own legal systems. But so in looking at that, basically what you find is that very early on, there's these interesting examples and kind of cases of trying to fit, like to try to use older forms of Roman law, which was kind of rediscovered in the feudal period, but then to mishmash it with like ecclesiastical law, canon law, these other things. You start to get, you know, lots of people talk about merchant law, but even that is kind of over exaggerated. You know, merchants didn't have this one system of law that they used, you know, across Europe. Instead, they just would kind of usually be tried in a variety of courts. And then essentially that merchant law, whatever existed of it, eventually, depending on the country, gets kind of embedded in the existing system of laws. So that, for example, in England, much later, you have judges saying that essentially the merchant's law is the common law, right? And it's like they're the same. And so it kind of gets brought into that existing system. So for me, I'm very curious about all these things because I think, again, they play out in similar ways to things that we're seeing with the blockchain today. And that by focusing on some of those smaller transformations that eventually led to these big revolutions and big transformations of whole political economic systems, that we might be able to kind of learn some lessons from that about what's happening today and then kind of be able to orient ourselves to the future a little bit better.
Yeah, so then I guess you would say that this notion that the bourgeoisie or artisans or craftsmen, merchants, as being sort of the leaders in creating what would I guess proto-capitalism by making these small little cities and doing capitalism with each other, wasn't necessarily always a direct contest of the monarchy's power. Like it was there was much more of I guess similarly how capitalism co-opts leftist things. I guess the monarchy sort of co-opted capitalism in a way, and then it just sort of
Yeah, it's
grew
like
from within itself.
the sorcerer's magic that he can't control at a certain point, right? And like the Disney thing. But I think, yeah, because you have so many examples as well of those merchants. You know, if they really were so antagonistic, you wouldn't see them constantly trying to get, for example, noble titles, to buy noble titles, to become nobles themselves, Yet, of course, we see that all across that period, right? Is those people actually wanting to enter into a class that they were barred from. But slowly, through different measures, they were able to purchase titles. Depends on the country, the extent of which that happens. Of course, also depends on religion and things like that, because we can take someone like the Rothschilds are a good example of this, right? They made lots and lots of money lending money to monarchs back in the day, and eventually get to a certain point where they're so wealthy that they're much wealthier than many of the monarchs that rule the countries that they're operating in. And of course, they split up their family, so they're operating in all these different countries at the same time. But then, even then, despite all that power, despite the fact that they're wealthier than the monarchs in the countries in which they're living, they still want the noble titles. And for example, in England, they struggle and they try so hard to get a noble title. And of course, they're Jewish, and so that adds an extra complication, given, you know, the English monarch's kind of religious Protestantism. And so you kind of get to this point where finally they're able to kind of purchase things. But like even after this period where they had become nobles, like they're even trying to become like MPs, you know, like just a member of parliament. And even that they were barred from doing because of their religion and things like this. So all this to say, it's just a lot more complicated than I think a lot of existing narratives of this transition lead on or give us. And that we bring some of that complexity back, like some of what I would consider the actual reality of how those things happened, it allows us to actually apply it to our existing complexity in a little bit more of a straightforward way, where we can start to see some of those similar like threads happening. Like, so again, I mentioned earlier, you know, by the time you get to the kind of 16th and 17th century, you start to see a big discourse emerging about, you know, it's actually beneficial if the state can't seize money. And, you know, there's kind of a mix of people saying like, hey, the state shouldn't take our money and so on. And then also other people saying, almost trying to convince the monarchs and so on to be like, hey, if you stop seizing our wealth, we can make you really rich. Like, you can just tax us a little bit and you're going to be even wealthier. And you kind of have some of those arguments and kind of trying to convince. But again, they're also joining into that noble class, or at least trying to in many cases. And similarly, you know, you go back even further, and, you know, I talked about this transformation of laws that was happening, where they're kind of adding in different aspects of Roman law that related to kind of exchange and trade and property and things like that into this kind of religious law and other forms of law that existed. Well, who are the people that are actually doing that? Well, it's this new class of kind of lawyers and people like that are working for these kind of proto-states, you know, working in the courts of the monarchs. Well, where did they come from? Well, of course, they're the children of merchants and this merchant class, right? So they also embed themselves in the state and work to transform its laws that hundreds of years later, it pays off. Now, did they know any of that was going to happen? No, of course not. They weren't conscious of this grand plan to create capitalism when they were doing it. That's something we've given them after the fact. So I think it's really important to bring that understanding and complexity about those actors when they were doing all those things in the world that they were living in, to try to apply it to the situation today. Because of course, you know, when you look at, for example, the way that blockchain technology is emerging, you have lots of people involved. It's not just a capitalist class doing this, right? And it's not something I would argue that's even necessarily happening just from above, you know, like a lot of this is happening from below, and just a lot of people that for whatever political reasons or whatever, the technology speaks to them. And so they want to develop it and develop it in their own understanding of what they think freedom is or liberty or all these things. And yet all those things could have like wildly interesting consequences down the road for our whole makeup of our society and how we understand ourselves. So that's where I think kind of going back and complexifying those earlier transitions would maybe do us good, you know, to kind of take into account some of that. Cause at least it allows us to, again, get away from what I think happens with some of the more critical blockchain literature, where everything is just the result of capital and capital. And it's like, well, yes and no, like yes, in the sense that, you know, private property obviously influences all of us in the way we think, and those relationships have some meaning, but it's not like this dominating force, because otherwise, how could we be having the discussion that we're having today, right? There's lots of different viewpoints and so on, so.
Exactly. And I guess to as maybe because in the UK, don't I mean, like, a lot of rich people have noble titles. I don't know. So like I think isn't Richard Branson a knight or something?
I think he might have been made one later on, but yeah, you're totally right.
You
I
see
mean, I
there's definitely a residue of the past, so to say.
yeah, well, like we just have so many examples in that sense, right? Where, you know, again, I think part of this older narrative that we've kind of been misled by is that this, like, you know, if you think about Marx and you think about these revolutions and the emerging capitalist class and all this stuff, it's like, well, who are these capitalists, right? Who becomes the industrial capitalist that is the main, let's say, actor in Marx's narrative and other writers that kind of look back at that period of time? Well, you know, again, we have this older narrative of it's just these merchants that they eventually get enough money and then they start getting into banking and finance and more complex stuff. And then, but wait a minute, when Marx was writing, he said, no, the financiers are these parasites, and that really it's the industrial capitalists that are doing something productive, right? And so they're the interesting actor. But you're like, wait a minute, are these two different groups of people, or are they actually the same people? And in some case, are they also actually nobles? Because we have lots of examples of, you know, back then what might be considered progressive nobles saying, yeah, I want to do that with my property too. I have all this land. I would love to divide it up and sell some of it because I could make a bunch of money. And in particular, I'm looking at all these wealthy bankers and merchants, and they're saying, hey, like, we would love to sell your property for you. Or, hey, we have all these complex financial instruments that you can now start to use, right? Like the emergence of like insurance, right? Things like that. All these type of new kind of things happen. And, you know, I'm a little bit more familiar with the Canadian case being from Canada, but we have this long-standing debate in Canadian political economy over, you know, whether Canada's capitalist class is, we're all kind of a merchant class and thus financiers and thus dependent on, you know, foreign companies, mainly, you know, first British and then American, coming and having branch plants. And really, they're the ones that, because they're producing stuff, that we just siphon off some of the money for our own capitalist class, but really the value is being taken out of our country. Or are the capitalist class in Canada themselves kind of imperialists, right? That they really are their own independent capitalist class, and it's just kind of a historical accident that they all end up in banking or the commercial sector and not in production, like in industrial activities. But again, when you go back to the history, you find so many examples of these early merchants and financiers trying to get into industrial ventures almost anywhere they could, right? They were just throwing money, like, oh my God, you want to build a sugar refinery? Yeah, here, have a bunch of money. That would be great. And then, of course, there's just failures everywhere, right? Or maybe the area where that production occurred moved. So it moved from this region to this other region, and the capitalists in that region lost out or whatever, right? But all this to say, yeah, it's so much more complex, and the class cleavages between some of these groups that we've come to solidify as like real different groups. In reality, it's not that easy, right? Class is a nice kind of, let's say, sociological category of analysis that allows us to look at certain movements in certain ways. But when you actually look at how class plays itself out in some of those struggles, it kind of changes the direction of how we consider that maybe movement to be. And I mean, again, I think we see this with blockchain, right? It's not a project of the capitalist class. So even though it's being co-opted and whatever, right? You know.
Definitely, I would agree. It's it I think it's one of the few things that's I mean, it's very difficult to call it a project of the capitalist class, but the capitalist class wants in on it,
Of
for
course,
sure.
yeah. Just
I
as
think
the nobles wanted in on the, you know, that sweet tax revenue from the merchants in the towns that, you know, and they were like, great, let's, hey, we can have a deal. But in those deals, you end up complexifying kind of their relationship with one another, and then eventually, of course, the whole global political economy. Yeah, I think if you're trying to make money, you try to make money wherever. It doesn't, you don't really give a shit if it's here or there. But so based on this research, I was really curious to hear, I guess from you, if there were anything like specific in looking at this transition in what we would look at a possible transition away from capitalism. Like, is there something that you see today that looks like some sort of transition away from capitalism, although maybe difficult to when you're in the moment, I think it's difficult to know. If you had any thoughts on that.
I mean, it's impossible to predict the future, so it's tough to know whether the things that I might be saying are good examples are actually leading us into like a way worse dystopia or something like that. But I will say that I think a really good first step that we're starting to see emerge is the rise of kind of platform co-ops, particularly blockchain based. And I think that's a really good start because, it seems like as much as everyone uses Facebook and Uber and Amazon and everything else, they also hate all those things, right? Like even people that are kind of supporters of the idea, I have people that I know that are like, taxis were the worst. Like, yeah, I hate Uber as a company and their business practices, but like, man, it's so much more convenient to just get my phone out and I can grab an Uber and whatever. And it's like, if we can, as we're seeing with all these kind of co-ops emerging, if you can just do that and take out the Uber, I think that's an easy transition for a lot of people, right? And particularly for those who maybe have some sort of negative feelings toward co-ops for whatever reason, maybe historical or otherwise, but that's a really easy win, right? Like I think that's really low-hanging fruit. And so I see the kind of widespread emergence of that and hopefully adoption of that on a much wider scale. If that happens, that would be really positive, I think, because I think to me, those sort of things are the things that start getting people to think about, like, well, wait a minute, if we're doing that with Uber, like, why don't we do that with everything, and then, but I also think I want to clarify too that while I think that's a good step, we also have to be careful of this kind of idea that we're all going to be like individual entrepreneurs and that that's actually the freedom that we want. Because I think inherent to a lot of that co-op model is that, like, I'm still working and someone's just paying me directly. Well, that's not really socialism to me, right? That's almost what we would consider, if we want to use Marxist terms, like a form of petty commodity production, right? Where it's like the original view of people like Jefferson in the United States and so on is a nation of small landowners that are working their own land, and that's, and then they sell their stuff to each other, and that's freedom. Well, yeah, I don't think that's freedom, at least the way that I want to imagine my utopia, right? So that's kind of, I think, one of the drawbacks and dangers of that, and that I think is also really inherent to the blockchain space. Also, because a lot of people work as individual contractors, particularly in tech space, that's a much more kind of popular way of working than it is otherwise. And so I think people see a lot of freedom in that. And then even maybe having certain co-ops being able to kind of maybe even soften that a little bit more. But to me, all that kind of stuff, it also takes away from, for example, things like benefits, right? Like lots of people get lots of health benefits from working for some big company. Well, okay, then could we think about a different way of doing benefits rather than being like, oh, the goal is to have all of us working in like these kind of peer-to-peer co-ops and things like that, right? So I think the co-op kind of way that things are going is like an easy first step and a logical kind of transition. But that's where I think we're going to have to start to see emerge if we, let's say, want to have some sort of socialist society emerge, is then starting to think about, okay, how can we use blockchain to mediate actual common property and not just in things that we're exchanging for either money or cryptocurrency or even other services, but rather for nothing, like literally going to that maxim of, everyone gets what they need to the best of their abilities, sort of to badly paraphrase Marx, right? Where I don't want my ability to purchase housing or clothes or shelter or food or et cetera, to depend on like how many times I drive for the, ride sharing co-op. I actually just want to have that stuff as a right of being a human being. And so that's where I think it becomes interesting and something that I'm not seeing a lot of in the blockchain space is interesting ways of mediating those sort of that sort of exchange, right? Like, how do you use the blockchain to mediate common properties? How do you use the blockchain to mediate, for example, a system of healthcare? How do you use the blockchain to mediate a system of universal basic income or something like that, right? So, or let's say water. How do you use blockchain to manage common property resources and water? How do you use it to share electricity and internet amongst a lot of people, not for monetary gain, but for just making sure everyone has it, right? So that's something where I think that's going to be the struggle. And that's obviously a struggle because we live in a capitalist society and you need money to do all those things. So, it's not a big incentive for people to be like, oh, I want to drive in the rideshare for free. Like I don't want to drive my car. I'm just driving people around all the time for free or whatever, right? So I think that's the bigger thing. And that's, we've talked about other times about how a lot of this stuff has to do with developments that are outside the blockchain space, right? They're much bigger transformations. And so that's something that I kind of see a need for, to hopefully kind of start thinking about new ways that we could use the blockchain that would actually kind of aid that transition that isn't just a world of co-ops, right? Because I mean, to again paraphrase Marx, the corporation, the joint stock corporation, at least in its modern form, was really just emerging as Marx was kind of dying. And, if you look in Capital, you have a remark, I think, in the third volume of Capital where Engels, who, edited and finished the third volume, has a little section where, because Marx said, basically it's kind of interesting because it could allow for worker co-ops, but because it's emerging under capitalism, it's probably just going to turn into a tool for capitalists to have, they own individually their shares, but the management is done on behalf of the owners of the shares, and those shares probably aren't going to be workers. So that's going to be tough. And then Engels has to make this note that says, actually, since the time that Marx wrote this, joint stock corporations benefiting capitalists have become like absolutely huge and, only within a couple of years. So it looks like he was right. So I think we're kind of maybe, at least in terms of the blockchain, there's kind of that similar potential for error or potential to be misguided a little bit and seeing the emergence of all these co-ops is like, oh, this is it. It's actually happening. And you're like, well, yes and no. Like co-ops, I think, are a really good first step, but I don't see that as like a final step or somewhere to rest our laurels on.
No, yeah. It's... But I'm also a pretty big proponent of cooperatives, but mostly just as like a small form of socialism, just to sort of for me, I think if people just experience more regularly like democratic ownership of the means of production in the small sense, then it helps them imagine in a big sense. But I think it was interesting you said earlier, Thomas Jefferson saying that, America being a country of landowners, essentially, is, my thoughts immediately were like, but then after that, they did create, like, capitalism in a pretty big sense, like, starting off with this very small, idea and change, although, yeah, obviously we're trying to transition away from that, but maybe that's in the form of cooperatives, I think, are just one of those things, but that doesn't replace all the different type of work that you'll have to do outside of that.
Yeah, and I mean, just kind of thinking on that note, like I'm always reminded of an older comment by Noam Chomsky talking about, He's identifies as a libertarian anarchist, and which is to say a leftist anarchist. And, someone asked him some question about the state and how can you support the state or whatever. And he was like, well, I obviously don't support the state, but he's like,
if you don't create some alternative institution to take care of some of those things that the state does, like you're going directly into almost a worse form of society, right? Because I mean, like, again, I live in Canada right now. I have access to universal healthcare. Now, that healthcare could be a lot better. There are a lot of changes that could be made to it. It's not the best, but at the same time, I don't want to give that up, you know? And so I don't see any other, for example, institution, and especially in the blockchain space, thinking about how could we replace those things that the state actually does? Because right now it's mainly focused on things like money or work, right? How could we make kind of more cooperative models of those things? But there's a whole bunch of other very material things that have to do with, again, shelter, clothing, water, food, healthcare, whatever, that no one's really doing a lot of work on, or at least that I can tell. And, you know, I want the state to die just as much as the next, you know, full-blooded anarchist. But until we can start to create alternative institutions that basically are a better model and show people that this would be a way less exploitative and violent existence, I don't want to get rid of the state, you know?
Yeah.
Because until that happens, well, then basically you're just calling for a kind of no holds barred society of, you know, all
Mad
against
Max,
all. Yeah, exactly. Right. And I think there's this idea that it's like, oh, well, that's necessary to then create the utopia, because then we need to start from scratch. And I'm like, I don't know. I'm wary on that kind of trajectory, let's say, because I mean, you know, anytime you start something like that, it has to be, at least historically, the models that we've seen have been pretty violent and exploitative, even under the guise of doing it on behalf of the working class or the people and so on. So I'm kind of suspect of that model. But we'll see.
This was a super interesting conversation. I was thinking, are there any places that if someone is interested in your work or like wants to follow you that they can go to?
Yeah, I mean, I just have like a small website that just has some of my papers and things on it that people can go to if they want to read more. It's just on Google, like a Google Sites page. So I think if they just search for my name, Joel Garrod, it should be one of the top things that come up. So,
all right.
But that's cool. It.
Nice. Well, thanks a lot. I learned a lot from all the things that you've said. And yeah, I hope that you're staying safe out there, still under quarantine.
Yep, you as well. Hope things are well. And thanks again. This was really fun, and it's always really nice to be able to kind of talk about a mix of, you know, classical political economy and blockchain at the same time. So I don't get to do that. So this is great.
Right. You're always welcome to do it here.
Perfect. All right. Well, when my next paper comes out, maybe we'll have another chat about that, and we can go from there.
Definitely.